Prime Minister Viktor Orban. Today, in an unprecedented move by a European leader, Orban hosted the leader of Germany's far-right Alternative for Germany party, AfD, ahead of an election in 2 weeks, even as other Western leaders have sought to contain the party. At least one key member of Trump's new administration has closely studied Orban, the controversial far-right pundit Sebastian Gorka, who previously worked at the Hungarian Ministry of Defense before Orban and is now Trump's deputy assistant to the president's senior National Security Council director for counterterrorism, a top post that did not require Senate confirmation. Gorka advised Trump in his first term, but was pushed out after The Forward revealed he once had ties to a Hungarian far-right Nazi-allied group and that he supported an anti-Semitic and racist paramilitary militia in Hungary. This week, Gorka addressed a security forum.
If you share our values, you are on Team Western Civilization. Not just Western Hemisphere, Western Civilization. President Trump stated the following: the only question of our time is if we have the will to defend and save our civilization from those who wish to destroy it. If you believe that, the next 4 years will be beautiful for you and America.
This comes as candidates for top national security positions are now facing questions that appear to be a Trump loyalty test, including whether they accept his false claim that he won the 2020 election. For more, we're joined by Kim Lane Shepley, professor of sociology and international affairs at Princeton University, specializing in the rise and fall of constitutional government, focusing on Hungary. Her recent guest essay for The New York Times is headlined, "Are We Sleepwalking into Autocracy?" Professor Shepley, welcome back to Democracy Now! Why don't you answer your question? What are you seeing in this country as you lived for many years in Hungary and what you saw there?
Yeah, well, so first of all, nice to be back with you. Unfortunately, we're under very difficult circumstances. And so I think it's really important in looking at how democracies fail these days. And the crucial thing to say about Hungary is that it was a robust democracy, sort of top of its class in Eastern Europe in 2010, when Viktor Orban came to power. And by the end of that decade, virtually all of the democracy raters rated it as no longer a democracy. I would say the collapse happened even faster. Really, Orban did almost everything to undermine democracy for Hungary's future just in the first 3 years. So as we're looking at what's happening now in Washington, one of the things we see is this everything, everywhere, all at once attack on all of the pillars of democracy. And that was exactly how Orban did it. Came into power while he'd been out of power for 8 years before he was elected in 2010. He had private law firms, private groups write a blueprint so that when he was, as soon as he took office, he could hit the ground running and just, you know, come out with thousands of pages of laws with all kinds of programs that hit sort of every sector of civil society, of the economy, you know, all at once. And that's exactly what we're seeing here is that kind of playbook.
And Professor Shepley, I'm wondering, is in your studies, is there any essential or qualitative difference between an autocratic government and a fascist government? Does it even is it even worthwhile to make the distinction? What's your sense?
Yeah, well, so I tend not to be very big on labels in this area, in part because as soon as you define what each of these regimes looks like, someone like Orban, who actually does read and actually is pretty knowledgeable, unlike the U.S. president, who, shall we say, probably hasn't gotten all the way through a book in a long time, Viktor Orban knows what he's doing. And so as soon as you label him something, he will do something that misses, you know, item four on what you have to get the label. So I'm a little nervous about the labels. And, you know, fascism, I think, it also means an ideology. What I'm concentrating on when I talk about autocracy is the system of checks and balances that allows for the future rotation of power and that prevents it from being captured by one political faction. Now, you know, governments that are trying to capture all the levers of power can have all kinds of surface ideologies. Now, what we're seeing is that Trump is even echoing a lot of Orban's rhetoric. So if you think Orban's a fascist, you probably think Trump is as well. But for me, the really crucial thing is, you know, are you eliminating checks and balances? Are you eliminating the things that allow future elections to be free and fair? And what we're seeing, I think, you know, as Trump has come to power with this blitz, with this program, this Project 2025 program, written by private actors, you know, while Trump was out of power, is that he's attacking the nerve centers of American government. I think one thing we've missed is that, you know, the first places that Elon Musk went into were the Office of Personnel Management, so controlling the entire federal workforce, the Treasury controlling all of the payments, as well as the budget, you know, in and out of money, in and out of government, and then the General Services Administration, which controls all the buildings and the facilities, but also all the IT. So they went first into these nerve centers, and we still don't know exactly what they've done there, but it seems as people are trying to figure out what they've done, that they didn't just steal data, but they also did things like put spyware on the computers of people at Treasury. So they're monitoring everything that those people are doing. They're building a kind of centralized dashboard that can be, you know, looked at from the White House and you know, allow the president, or Musk, if he's the ex-president, as I think we should call him, to allow the people in the White House to exercise direct control over federal agencies without going through any intermediaries, any Senate-confirmed appointments, or any checks and balances on the system. Now, you know, Orban did that, too. He centralized everything in the office of the prime minister. The cabinet secretaries became, if not irrelevant, then certainly not where the action was. And it's that really sudden and extreme concentration of power that I think we have to keep our eye on and be very worried about.
And can you talk about Orban's role in terms of Project 2025, the Danube Institute and its relationship with the Heritage Foundation, and also his attempt to become a center for right-wing movements throughout Europe?
Yeah, exactly. So first of all, you know, when Project 2025 came out, I sat down and read it. And the first thing I thought was, you know, this sounds so much like what Orban did. And then it turns out a month later, there was a terrific article in the New Republic that made the connection. So Orban has this English language think tank. It's called the Danube Institute. You can Google it and see what it's up to. And the Danube Institute had entered into a formal agreement with the Heritage Foundation to actually provide consulting on how the Trump people were going to copy what Orban had done. In the meantime, you know, when Orban gives his Hungarian language speeches, one of the things he keeps saying is, you know, we are deep into the Trump administration and, you know, involved in its, you know, central planning. So you put all this together, and it's actually not just that the Trump people are aping Orban from a distance. It's that Orban has actually been involved in the design of Project 2025. Now, this mirrors, you know, what Orban has also done in Europe. So the European elections, the elections to the European Parliament, were held last June, and Orban's Fidesz party spent more money on campaigning for fellow far-right parties in other countries, like not just in Hungary, but in countries all over Europe, than any other single party in Europe. And remember, Hungary is a tiny country, you know, 9.5 million people on the edge of Europe. They're advertising in Germany, they're advertising in France, they're advertising in much bigger countries. And it turns out that this advertising, along with the general, you know, sort of collapse and weaknesses of party systems across Europe, meant that the far right had victories really all over the place. And Orban was able to take those far right victories and cobble together what has become the third largest political party in the European Parliament. And so that's an incredible political accomplishment. And what you're seeing is that Orban is now sort of riding atop this wave of election victories across Europe and claiming to be, you know, the heart and soul of this new far-right movement. He was president of something called, rotating president of what's called the council, in the last half of 2024. And when he unveiled his presidency, the slogan was, "Make Europe Great Again," which was also the slogan of this far-right gathering that we just saw in Spain as Orban pulled together all these far-right parties. So, you know, Orban's a prime minister of a tiny country on the edge of Europe, but he is now punching far above his weight in trying to consolidate this movement of anti-democratic far-right forces.
This is Hungarian Prime Minister Viktor Orban welcoming Donald Trump's inauguration last month.
A csillagzat, amely alatt most állunk, sokkal...
The stars under which we stand now are much more favorable than they were in 2024. Not only we became stronger, but in the meantime, the flagship of the Western liberal politics had sunken. The Western world received a patriotic, pro-peace, anti-migration, pro-family president in Washington.
So if you could respond to what Orban is saying, Professor Shepley, but also one of the things you point out is that you have these authoritarian leaders that don't just take power. I mean, even Hitler won an election. Orban won an election. And then what that process is, consolidating the power, so much so that right now President Trump, what is it, hundreds of executive orders? But isn't that a sign of weakness, not strength? I mean, he's got the House and the Senate. Why can't he pass these laws and not get around them with Republicans in the majority in both houses?
Right. So actually, if you remember, in Donald Trump's first term, he had even larger majorities in both houses for the first half of his first term. And even then, he did not move to legislation. So I think part of the reason is that Trump wants to move fast. Orban also wanted to move fast. You know, Orban, in his first year in office, amended the Hungarian Constitution 12 times, changing 60 different provisions of the Constitution. Orban had a supermajority in his parliament, so he was able to work with them. Trump has got razor-thin majorities now in both houses. Also, amending the U.S. Constitution is beyond the bounds of almost any single political party. So Trump is doing something else, and this is the crucial thing about the autocratic playbook. It doesn't look exactly the same in every country because not the political systems don't look exactly the same. So Trump is trying to break things quickly so that by the time the courts catch up with him, by the time his own party starts to have second thoughts, by the time all of the forces that are checks and balances regroup and figure out how to push back, the thing will be broken. You know, so I think what Trump has learned and what Orban also, I think, taught him is that, you know, think of government as an aquarium. If you just stick a blender in it and make fish soup, you're not going to be able to restore the aquarium, even when courts tell you, no, you shouldn't have done it like that. So this is really, you know, break things first, act fast to create facts on the ground. And then when especially the judiciary is slow to catch up with you, you can't do anything. So let me give you one example from Hungary. In order to capture the judiciary, what Orban did was to suddenly lower the judicial retirement age from 70 to 62. And in Hungary, like most European countries, the judiciary is a civil service activity. So you come in as a baby judge, you get promoted through the ranks. The people who are the oldest are also the most senior. So you suddenly lower the retirement age effective like today. All these judges are forced out of office. They then bring a lawsuit saying, you know, we were improperly, illegally fired. A couple of years later, the European courts get around to saying, yes, that shouldn't have happened. This is a violation of European law. By that time, Orban's filled all the positions. He goes back to the court and said, well, do you want us to fire the new judges? At which point, the European Commission, which is enforcing this court decision, says, well, we really don't want you to fire any new judges. Just give the new judges protection so that this can't happen again. Okay? And what that meant, he captured all the courts and got European blessing for it all because he moved first, broke things. And this is what we're seeing. You know, Trump is just creating facts on the ground. He'll destroy agencies before the court tells him you have to restore them. So again, the metaphor is you start as an aquarium, you create the fish soup, and no court can make you go back.
We just have 20 seconds, but what about if these federal workers, if the heads of agencies simply refuse to leave, create the constitutional crisis on the other side, the judiciary has to rule, and instead of ruling years later when all these people are gone, they rule now, and the agencies don't get shut down.
Yeah, well, a few of the officials who have been fired have tried to make a last stand. You know, some of the inspectors general did and the head of the Federal Election Commission did. The problem in Washington is that they can just deactivate your badge at the door. So in Poland, when the judges went back into court after their retirement age was lowered, they could get into the court. But in our government, It's very difficult because the buildings themselves have so much security. But still, I think it's good for people who are in office to say, I'm not leaving until you force me. And just create friction in the system, slow it down, is actually the best defense in circumstances like this.
Professor Kim Lane Shepley, want to thank you for being with us, professor of sociology and international affairs at Princeton University, specializing in the rise and fall of constitutional government with a special focus on Hungary. We'll link to your piece in The Times. Are we sleepwalking into autocracy? Next up, Tarek Ali. We speak to him as President Trump repeats his threat to take over Gaza, not buy it, just have it, and ethnically cleanse the entire population. Tarek Ali's new book, You Can't Please All. Back in 20 seconds. Street Fighting Man by the Rolling Stones is about our next guest, Tarek Ali. Mick Jagger wrote it for Tarek. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is threatened to renew Israel's attacks on the Gaza Strip, saying the Israeli military will return to, quote, intense fighting unless Hamas agrees to release all remaining hostages by Saturday noon. This comes after President Trump said all hell is going to break out if the hostages aren't freed. Hamas has accused Israel of repeatedly violating the ceasefire. Meanwhile, Trump on Tuesday met with Jordan's King Abdullah at the White House, where Trump repeated his threat to take over Gaza and displace the entire Palestinian population. Reporters questioned Trump about his Gaza proposal.
Mr. President, you said before that the U.S. would buy Gaza, and today you just said we're not going to buy Gaza.
We're not
going
to have to buy. We're going to have Gaza. We don't have to buy. There's nothing to buy. We will have Gaza.
What does that mean?
No reason to buy. There is nothing to buy. It's Gaza. It's a war-torn area. We're going to take it. We're going to hold it. We're going to cherish it.
Mr. President, take it under what authority? It is sovereignty.
Under the U.S. authority.
That was President Trump sitting next to a grimacing King Abdullah of Jordan, who later wrote that they will not accept the ethnic cleansing of Gaza. And the president of Egypt, President Sisi, canceled his trip to the White House next week after these comments. We're joined now by Tarek Ali, Pakistani-British historian, activist, filmmaker, editor of the New Left Review, author of over 50 books, including Just Out, You Can't Please All, Memoirs 1980 to 2024. Welcome back to Democracy Now! It's great to have you with us on this side of the pond. But I do have to ask you, Mick Jagger wrote that Rolling Stones song for you, Street Fighting Man?
Yeah, he wrote it and sent it to me, a handwritten version, saying, could you put this in the paper? I just wrote this for you. I edited a radical newspaper at the time. And the BBC are refusing to play this song. So we did publish the song, and of course, a few weeks later, the BBC did play it. I mean, that was a time when politics and culture, radical politics, radical culture, were very mixed up together in a good sense.
So let's go back to Gaza. You have President Trump doubling, tripling, quadrupling down, saying he doesn't even have to buy Gaza. He'll have it. He'll take it. He's also said, originally said, the world's people will be there, yes, including Palestinians now. No, Palestinians have no right of return. Your response to what's going on there?
It is so appalling, Amy, what is going on now. Trump says it in public what his predecessors used to say in private, that effectively they're going to let Israel have its way, both in Gaza and, believe you me, in the West Bank. They will both be ethnically cleansed. That has been Israeli policy for decades, and now they feel they've had leaders in the United States. Trump is, of course, shameless and open about it. Biden did exactly the same thing. For 6 months, Hamas had agreed to the ceasefire plan. Netanyahu didn't want a ceasefire, and Biden backed him. So one problem we have today, that the reason you have Trump is because the previous administration was so weak-willed and so weak-minded and incapable of doing anything, whereas in this very country we had Reagan, Bush, Truman calling Israel to heel when they exceeded what was considered to be decent, honorable, according to the United States policies. When they refused to obey, they were called to heel. Neither Biden and now Trump calling these people enough. The whole world is seeing what you're up to. Enough. We will not tolerate Netanyahu threatening to break the ceasefire. And the response of the United States president is what? The response says nothing to do with the ceasefire, but we're going to take Gaza. We can. The Israelis have got it for you by killing over 100,000 people. And now we'll do with it as we please. I mean, if this is the way the United States empire is going to carry on functioning, there will be more and more, not immediately, there will be more and more resistance. If even the King of Jordan and Sisi in Egypt, who have so far backed the United States, are getting slightly scared, it's not because they've changed greatly, it's they're scared there will be an uprising in their countries. Jordan is three-quarters Palestinian anyway, and the Egyptian masses are seething. So we have a really extremely serious situation building up in the Middle East, where they publicly, in front of everyone, want to expel the Palestinians. No cover-up. Netanyahu says we're going to do it. The U.S. president supports him.
And Tariqa, the famous Palestinian-American intellectual Edward Said was a friend of yours. You write about him in your memoir. Said was prophetic in many ways in terms of his skepticism of the possibility of a two-state solution. What are your sense of how he would have responded to what's happening today?
Well, Edward was a very dear friend. We often discussed Palestine. And he felt, as did many others, that the only serious solution for that region was a one-state solution with equal rights for all its citizens, male, female, Jews, non-Jews, etc. That was the only way we could proceed, because a two-state solution had become a joke. I mean, if you look what's been happening in Gaza for a year, an open genocide. If you see what they're starting to do to the West Bank now, a two-state solution is impossible. No one will believe in it. But a single-state solution is also now become very difficult, in my opinion. It's the worst situation to confront the Palestinians. I mean, 70%, between 60 and 70% of the Israeli population back Netanyahu. You have large numbers of Zionist citizens of Israel coming out and chanting once again, kill the Arabs, just like many German fascists shouted, kill the Jews. What is going on? And the U.S., in my opinion, has completely abdicated its role to be an arbiter. It never was an arbiter, but now that's just become a complete joke. So the situation seems grim to me. And whether it can be resolved simply within the area currently Israel-Palestine, or whether it will have to expand and extend to the rest of the Arab world before people see sense, is an open question.
And I'm wondering, as you mentioned the situation in Israel, clearly we just had a segment talking about authoritarianism in Europe as well, the rise of fascist and right-wing movements through, and especially anti-immigrant movements throughout Europe. What is your sense of the role or the problems in terms that the left has had in confronting these movements?
The real problem, Juan, is this, that all political parties, prior to the rise of these extreme right parties that the professor was talking about, prior to that, we had a center-left and a center-right. Both of them supported the economic system we call neoliberalism, a very extreme, rampant for, type of turbocharged capital, which wrecked the social structure of many of these countries, privatized large industries, entered into the domains of health and most sacred and hallowed sections of the old post-Second World War state. And that collapse, and the fact that parties of the center-left and center-right, whenever they came to power, did exactly the same thing. I wrote a book called The Extreme Center about these groups. They've now been shown to be what they were, which is useless. So there's a great hostility against these politicians. And there is nothing on to the left of them in most places. France is an exception. And what people do now is turn to the right, saying we've tried all these jokers out. These guys are talking what seems to be our language. Let's see what they're like. And from that point of view, this big turn to the far right, in a sort of curious way, it's fitting that the champion now sits at the White House, the most right-wing president in recent years, especially on the domestic front. So there is a symbiosis taking place between the European far right and the far right government we seem to have got in the United States, and how they will work together. I mean, one problem they have is, and this should be talked about, that Zelensky's government in Ukraine, its hardcore, are not just people who are far right, but they are actual lineal descendants of Ukrainian Nazis who have been fighting. We shouldn't forget that, too. It's part of the picture. Just because the West is backing Ukraine doesn't mean that these things are not going on there. So it's very difficult to give this a gloss. What is happening in the West as a whole is pretty disastrous. It's not just Orban. He's very open, like Trump. Yeah, this is what we're doing. We don't care what you think. We're going to do it. We've been elected. We have the power to do it. There are people like that, but there are another layer of people who supposedly oppose them, who, when it comes down to it, have policies which are not all that different. I mean, what the United States and much of Europe needs today is an opposition which fights back politically, intellectually, with arguments, and when necessary, comes out on the streets, extra parliamentary actions to defend democracy.
We just have 30 seconds. The most important message following up on that rising up at the grassroots you feel people need to hear around the world now from your decades of activism.
I think we need activists more than ever before. I mean, one of the most amazing things has been this opposition by students in this country, occupations of universities in defense of the people, the Palestinians and the people of Gaza. We now need to extend these movements to what is happening domestically.
We're going to continue this conversation and post it online at democracynow.org. Tariq Ali, Pakistani-British historian, activist, filmmaker, editor of the New Left Review. Latest book, You Can't Please All, Memoirs 1980 to 2024. Happy birthday to Messiah Rhodes, Dante Terrieri, and Rustam. I'm Amy Goodman, Juan Gonzalez.
Hey, do you want to make a real impact in the Black community? Join us where we connect you with Black-led organizations from all around the world. Get ready to get involved. Find the organization based on the location of interest. Follow us at supportblackcharities.org.
Stats can be hard to understand, but this one isn't.